NBC Monitor News on the hour. Here's Alec Gifford.
At least 50 South Vietnamese civilians are reported to have been killed in a Viet Cong mortar attack on the outskirts of the city of Da Nang. The mortar shells were apparently intended to land on a major U.S. communications center in Da Nang, but most of them overshot the area and hit a civilian compound nearby. At least 100 civilian huts were destroyed. However, some of the shells did hit within the communications center, damaging two army barracks and destroying two vans containing equipment. Several Americans were injured, but there was no specific information as to how many were hurt or how seriously. The North Vietnamese charged today that civilians are being killed by the American artillery bombardment of the North from vessels stationed off the coast. The U.S. military command reported earlier that artillery is being used to supplement airstrikes against the North because of bad weather which limits aerial operations. North Vietnam called this a new and serious step in the escalation of the war. In Saigon, the U.S. Embassy has declined to comment on reports that a special South Vietnamese tribunal set up to fight corruption is demanding bribes to free Americans being held in local jails. A spokesman said anything that might be said here or elsewhere would be grossly out of place. Moscow radio reports that new fighting has broken out in Red China in the continuing struggle between factions supporting and opposing party chairman Mao Zedong. The Moscow report says that army units opposed to Mao have captured the important industrial city of Luoyang, which is about 500 miles south of Peking. The broadcast said fighting is now underway in other provinces, but it gave no further details. The Atomic Energy Commission today said it detected seismic disturbances last night, which indicate the Russians have set off another underground nuclear explosion. A similar announcement was made yesterday by a Swedish seismological station. The former deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Robert Amory Jr., today criticized the nation's news agencies for continuing to name the organizations the CIA secretly financed. Amory, interviewed along with several others on a special edition of the NBC News program Meet the Press, said there are still many organizations which got CIA money, organizations which have not yet been named. He said it is dangerous to publish these names and said that when the names are published, as he put it, the gentlemen of the Fourth Estate might just as well be scuttling carriers in the Tonkin Gulf. The broadcast will be heard later tonight over NBC Radio. Meanwhile, Barry Goldwater, the former Republican candidate for president, said today in a CBS interview that as long as the CIA was financing certain organizations, he wishes the money could have been spread even more widely.
But what I question is why all of this money went to left-wing organizations. Now, a little money could have gone to the Young Republicans or the Young Americans for Freedom, some conservative groups, but they support Norman Thomas. They support the Newspaper Guild. They supported the name slipped me right now, but the Foreign Affairs Committee of the UAW, which fights constantly against the American foreign policy situation. Why didn't they spread this money around? In other words, what they've been doing with it, as far as I can see, is to finance socialism in America.
Former Senator Barry Goldwater. A dispute involving three South American nations has cast a cloud over the proposed Latin American Summit Conference, which President Johnson is planning to attend. One of the Latin presidents, René Barrientos of Bolivia, said today flatly he will not attend the conference, scheduled to take place in Uruguay April 12th through the 14th. Barrientos said he will not attend because the agenda does not include his country's demand for an outlet to the sea. And the presidents of Peru and Ecuador also indicated they may boycott the conference because the agenda fails to include specific topics they wanted to discuss. Sources in New Delhi say Mrs. Indira Gandhi is in danger of being ousted as Prime Minister of India. The Congress party which she heads maintained only a bare majority in Parliament as a result of last week's election, and India's political leaders are gathering in New Delhi to talk about forming a new government. Mrs. Gandhi will be under consideration for another term as Prime Minister, but there are at least two other Indian leaders also being considered, and sources in New Delhi say one of them may get the job. The rangers in Yellowstone National Park will go out at dawn tomorrow and start shooting 600 of the elk that roam the park. The purpose is to thin out the overpopulated herds of elk. a decision that brought a storm of criticism from Washington to Wyoming when it was first announced. However, a study was made, which resulted in the decision to go ahead with the plan. The herds are becoming so large they are destroying rangeland. A spokesman said about 25 of the elk will be shot each day by park rangers. The meat will be distributed to Indians living in the area. Alec Gifford, NBC News, New York.
Listen again on the hour for NBC Monitor News. Now Monitor passes along a conversation that, well, may not have really taken place, but it could have. Two well-dressed women were chatting by a swimming pool at the Huntington Sheraton Hotel in Pasadena, California. And one of them, showing the other one around, pointed out that it wasn't necessary to be a guest at the hotel to use the pool, that anyone could go in for a small fee. And the visitor said, "But how do they keep the riffraff out?" And her friend said, "My dear, in California, the riffraff have their own pool." I'm Brad Crandall, your host for Monitor 67, your listening post for the Weekend World. Now, just ahead, we'll be talking with John Scopes, central figure of the world-famous monkey trial in Tennessee over four decades ago. But first, Monitor Music. Here's Herb Alpert with Wade in the Water. Thank you. 41 years ago in Dayton, Tennessee, a young high school teacher named John Scopes was tried and convicted of teaching evolution. Now, this famous so-called monkey trial has been the subject of plays, a movie, and a TV program, and has been written about in countless magazines and newspapers. Now, Mr. Scopes has come forward to write his own version of what happened in that celebrated court action in which he was prosecuted by the great political orator William Jennings Bryan and defended by the brilliant trial lawyer Clarence Darrow. Now, Mr. Scopes, in your book, Center of the Storm, you state that you never did teach evolution in Dayton, Tennessee. Well, if that's true, then how did you happen to be convicted of doing it?
Because I agreed to let Darrow plead guilty.
Well, now, you had taught some biology courses, and the textbook for the biology courses did include a rough smattering, a very brief thing on evolution, didn't it?
I substituted for a biology teacher for about 10 days or 2 weeks. And if during that time that I was reviewing the part of the course that the class had already covered, if I touched upon evolution, I taught it. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember.
Well, you made the statement that nobody could teach that course from that book and not teach evolution.
You can't teach biology from any book without teaching evolution.
According to your book, sir, you never even appeared as a witness in this trial and never spoke in your own defense. How'd that happen?
Since we wanted to test the constitutionality of the law, and since it was a very strong probability that I hadn't taught evolution and the case could be thrown out of court if it were proved that I hadn't taught evolution, I had to stay off the stand and let Mr. Darrow handle it by stipulating that I was guilty. Then, as to the question of defending the position of the scientists, we brought in the men qualified to defend their position.
The expert witnesses.
The expert witnesses, both as to science and religion.
Mm-hmm. These men were allowed to file affidavits, but they were not allowed to testify. Isn't that the way it worked?
Well, one man was able to start testifying, Medcalf of Johns Hopkins.
Yeah.
But by the time the first question was asked of Professor Medcalf, the defense counsels objected, and then we had the arguments on the admissibility of that testimony.
And the jury was out during all of this anyhow?
Oh, yes. The jury was in long enough to be sworn in, hear a couple of boys say that they were in my class, and their testimony wasn't very conclusive, and Mr. Darrow got up and stipulated that I was guilty, and then the question of constitutionality of the law was the next order of business. The jury was excused and not allowed in the courtroom, and they didn't come back until I came before the judge and sentenced.
Yeah, you made the point that, like most small-town juries, most of the people wanted to be on the jury because it meant they had a good seat for the circus.
Yes.
And that in the case of this jury, they saw less of it than anybody else in town.
They didn't see any of the trial.
To go back to the beginning of the controversy, when you, the suggestion was first made that you become the defendant to test the law about the teaching of evolution, why did you accept?
Well, I think that if anybody had been trained to appreciate the importance of individual liberties, individual rights, and individual freedoms, I don't see how they could keep him doing anything else. Even if you didn't agree with the substance involved, the right for somebody to teach it, the right for somebody to believe it, the right for somebody to say it, they have that right. And to me, if you give up the most insignificant right, you open the door for losing all of your rights.
If I went to you tomorrow, same age, same place, but knowing what you know now, would you do it again?
Yes, I certainly would.
Mr. Scopes, it's been a great pleasure having you with us on Monitor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our guest, John T. Scopes, defendant in the famous monkey trial in Dayton, Tennessee, 41 years ago. Now the author of a book about it, a book called Center of the Storm.
Happiness that lies in store will be what I need. hated and loved by someone more unknown. I simply can't understand what my foolish heart was waiting for.
Now I know the feeling. Voice of Vicky Carr. You're listening to Monitor, and just ahead, we'll be hearing from Joe Garagiola with another sidelight on sports. So stay with us. You're on the Monitor, Deacon.
This is Stein Erickson speaking from Sugarbush, Vermont. New skiers who have just had a great weekend on the slopes, why not live and work in ski country all year long? Here is your opportunity to do just that. IBM in Burlington, Vermont needs more engineers, programmers, accountants, and scientists. If you qualify, you could have a gold places career with IBM, and you would have some of the country's best ski resorts in your backyard. But skiing is only part of the story. There is great hunting, fishing, boating, and hiking in the Burlington area, too.
You're right, Stein. New skiers who haven't yet had an interview with IBM, be sure to write to the company early this week. Just send an outline of your education and experience to IBM Corporation, Burlington, Vermont. That's IBM Corporation, Burlington, Vermont. You'll hear from IBM within a week. IBM is an equal opportunity employer.
Hello, I'm Brad Crandall, your host for Monitor, back once again. And a reminder now that Joe Garagiola is here for Monitor Sports. Here's Joe. Oh, I'm sorry, Joe's not here yet for another couple of minutes. I'm leaping ahead. I'm sorry about that. First, Jimmy Dean, a song about something that doesn't really sound possible, called Sweet Misery.
Oh, when I'm lonely, I think of someone. Someone I call sweet misery. In her arms I was in heaven. But heaven wasn't meant for me. I still love her, but I lost her. I mean, she walked out, the hurt walked in. Now our love's gone, just like an old song that no one ever wants to hear again. Heartaches that a big boom makes.
now, at long last, here's Joe Garagiola from Monitor Sports.
It used to be considered very accurate to describe the New York Knickerbockers as a basketball team that made a great success out of losing. Now all that has changed. The Knickerbockers have made it into the NBA playoffs for the first time since the 1958-59 season. The old routines don't apply anymore. Dick McGuire, the coach of the Knicks, has lots of reasons why his team has finally popped up with the new image. But no matter where he starts, McGuire always gets back to one thing. The Knicks coaches thought right along there was room in the big man's game for the six-footer, and now he's sure of it. McGuire points with great pride at the job his backcourt men have done. He refers to M. Bryant and Butch Comives, both of whom stand 6 feet 1 inch in their sneakers. McGuire maintains the driving play of these two players has contributed a lot to the success of the Knicks this year. McGuire says that without their hustling down court, his team most likely wouldn't be in the playoffs. In a way, you can understand McGuire's feelings on the subject of Bryant and Comines. During his playing days with the Knicks, McGuire was a modest 6 feet tall, yet a backcourt star who ranked close to the spectacular Bob Cousy as a ball handler and playmaker. It's only natural that McGuire would fully appreciate the contributions of performers who played the game something like the way he once did. Yet McGuire isn't alone in his views that the smaller man is coming back strong in the NBA. Jerry West, the superstar of the Los Angeles Lakers, stands a couple of inches over 6 feet. He has some rather positive things to say on the subject. West recalls how few players under 6 feet 2 inches there were in the NBA his first couple of years in the league. Now, says West, there are several six-footers, and coaches are beginning to realize that they can win with small, quick players. The Lakers coach, Fred Schaus, agrees. He says the widening of the lanes under the basket to 16 feet a few years ago put the accent on fast breaks. According to Schaus, this trend has quickened the game in the NBA. The Laker coach explains that in former years, the tendency was to wait for the pivot shooter to get into position. Now the game is geared for the smaller backcourt men as well. The big men, says Schaus, are getting their rebounds and pitching out to the smaller men who are constantly trying to beat the opposition down court to get off their shots. This emphasis on backcourt men is bringing a change to pro basketball. Players like West, the St. Louis Hawks' Lenny Wilkins, the Philadelphia 76ers' Hal Greer, and the Jones boys of the Boston Celtics, Casey and Sam, are taking on a greater importance in the faster play that's now in style in the NBA. I think this is good for a game which was becoming the exclusive property of the big man. This is Joe Garagiola for Monitor Sports, and now a word about Vigoro.
When the green in your grass is gone, and you gotta make it shape up, make it wake up with the bold green vigor of Vigoro. The bold green vigor of Vigoro.
You bet. And the answer is simple. Every Vigoro product is tailor-made for the area where it's sold. That's the secret behind the bold green vigor of Vigoro. Vigoro for goof-proof lawn food. You sure ought to try them.
Joe Garagiola is heard every weekend on Monitor and weekdays on NBC Radio.
Thank you.
The Bob Crew Generation with a man and a woman. This is Monitor, designed to entertain you at home or take along in your car anywhere you may go. In the area of Prescott, Arizona, we're heard on KYCA. Now, let's hear from all our NBC stations, then we'll be back.